going to focus on certain answers you can give to explain the existence of dinosaurs. I was wondering if the real could give us some explanations how we can explain the existence of hominids and other species of humans.
Well, you know, these are, you know, we don't have definitive answers to any of these questions, but the one possibility, which some have accepted and some have rejected, is that Adam HaRishon did not have to automatically be the first Homo sapien, but he was the first Homo sapien that had a godly soul. And that is, hominids or Homo sapiens may have existed, but they had the status of intelligent animals. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu made a person, or perhaps even chose one of that group, gave him a new neshama, gave him a godly soul with free will and the ability to connect to Hashem. So as a result, whatever fossils you find, whatever evidence you find of Homo sapiens, which are earlier than Maisa Bereishis, would reflect the animalistic aspect of man, but not the divine image of man. Now again, that is difficult because, you know, among others, you'll have a problem. How do you understand the idea that God made Adam from the dirt? According to this idea, there was the Adam, and God chose the Homo sapien and zapped him with a godly soul. That does not correspond to the description that he was made from the upper min ha'adamah. So that's why some consider this not to be a proper interpretation, but one answer might be that that's describing the earliest stage, meaning to say the godly soul is what happened at Maisa Bereishis, and the other stuff happened at an earlier time, some indeterminate time. But again, as I say, you know, some people would say these are wonderful answers, some people would say they're apikorsis. You know, so either they're great answers or they're absolutely awful answers. We don't have a definitive mahalik, but the point is that one should not become an apikoris because of these types of questions, because within a religious framework there are many, many possibilities that can exist. And the most important thing to remember is that the Torah did not intend to give you a complete scientific description of how creation took place, because the Torah is not concerned with how Hashem did it, it's concerned that Hashem did it. Meaning to say that the Torah is primarily a guide to how we should live. In fact, that's why the very first Rashi in Chumash raises the question, you know, why does the Torah, I mean, think about this first Rashi. The first Rashi raises the question, again, it's not his own question, it's from a Medrash, why does the Torah begin with Bereishis? The Torah should begin with HaChodesh HaZeh Lochem, which is the first mitzvah that the Jewish people were commanded to sanctify the new moon. Now, you could ask an obvious question. Why begin with Bereishis? In other words, skip? You're telling me skip the idea that God created the world? Just skip it? Don't say it at all? Yeah, that's what Rashi is saying. Rashi is saying the intrinsic, you know, step by step of how God created the world would not be of overarching theological importance, except for the fact that it establishes our claim to Eretz Yisrael, that Rashi says, by God creating the world. So that really highlights the idea that the purpose of the Torah is mitzvos. The purpose of the Torah is to recognize the mission that Hashem gave Am Yisrael, initially the human race, and then Am Yisrael. And therefore, this scientific theory, now listen, everything has holes in it. The scientific theories have many, many holes in it, and I know that Rabbi Gottlieb, other people give all sorts of shiurim to show the inadequacies of evolution and the fact that one should never accept this scientific methodology as being fail-safe, and all of that is true. And one should study that. But the point I want to make is, even in an absolute worst-case scenario, that evolution and all of these theories were proven, and they're not, they're absolutely not, but even if they were, we could live with it. It would not. It does not affect the meaning of the Torah, the purpose of the Torah, and there are even ways of understanding the psukim. So we can live with almost anything science throws down our pathway. It does not undermine the foundations of faith. And indeed, Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, who lived at the time when Darwin's book was published, The Origin of Species, and Rav Hirsch was asked at the time, you know, if all of this is true, does this not undermine your faith in God creating the world and the Torah? And Hirsch said exactly what I said. I'm basically just quoting Rav Hirsch, who said, well, number one, a theory is not proof, but number two, even if it was proven, it just means that, you know, God operated this way instead of that way. And that's not really akasha, because as long as you believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu orchestrated the process, so we could accept all sorts of ways. Hashem is infinite, and there's an infinite number of tools that he has in his palette, and therefore this could also be a tool. Right? So that's kind of a mahalakha.
What's the makor to bride and groom not seeing each other a week before the wedding?
There actually is no clear makor at all, and in fact, Rav Moshe Feinstein used to tell chassans and kalas that they didn't have to worry about it. He personally said there's no big deal. However, one makor is really a very weak makor, but it actually has a good reason, and that is that there is a fear that people are very tense shortly before their weddings, and chas v'shalom, they see each other right before the wedding, they get nervous, that could cause machlokas, and therefore it's better to minimize your contacts. That's one idea. The second idea, which does have a halachic makor, is the Gemara suggests at various points that when you have a wedding that is upcoming, the kala's desire to be with the chassan in an intimate way might cause her to become a nida. It might cause menstruation. And that would not be good. Now, lemaisa, we do have procedures for a chassan and a kala getting married when the kala is a nida. But trust me, you really don't want to do that if that could be avoided in any possible way, because it would actually mean that they could, number one, couldn't consummate the marriage, and number two, they would not be allowed to live under the same roof for an entire 12 days, etc., or 11 days. So as a result, some say that the idea of the chassan not seeing the kala is to avoid what is called dam chimud. Dam chimud is blood that come, you know, nida blood that comes from desire. But again, that's a very, very weak makor. And Rosha Feinstein said, if there is a need to see each other, then one does not have to be overly machmer.
I could have this incorrect, but I heard that Rosh Benayim forcibly converted some people. Is there validity to that?
You know, that's a real, you know, that's putting a spin on a well-established halachic principle. Keep in mind that when a Jewish army conquers non-Jews, they can take the captives as slaves. That's just an eved. Now keep in mind, an eved kanani, a non-Jewish slave, is circumcised and immersed in a mikveh, and is chayav in mitzvos like a woman. So you could call that a forced conversion. Now, it's not a forced conversion to be a Jew. It's simply reflecting the fact that they took slaves. All slaves, like some Rishonim, are forcibly converted by virtue of their being slaves. Right? So when you read the statement in historical books that there were forced conversions, it essentially refers to the idea of the forced mila and tevila of an eved kanani, a non-Jewish slave. Now, I'm not sure if that answers things, but it just puts it in perspective, because in Hilchos Geirus, there is no such thing as a forced conversion. There was only one forced conversion in history. That's a major, very major conversion. Excuse me. That is the forced conversion of the Jewish people at Matan Torah, if you learn that God held the mountain over our heads. And in fact, the Maral has a very interesting chiddush. This contradicts something I said this morning, but the Mesher Chacham and the Maral argue on this. The Maharal raises the question, if all of the Jews at Matan Torah converted, then why would there be an incest prohibition between brother, sister, mother, daughter, mother, son, since they were not related? Now, if you recall, I actually told you, according to the Mesher Chacham, there was no incest prohibition because of the conversion. That's what I told you this morning. But the Maral, much earlier, disagreed with the Mesher Chachma's premise, and the Maral says the following chiddush, that the rule that conversion erases a relationship is only for voluntary conversions. It does not apply to involuntary conversions, And although there is no such thing as an involuntary conversion, Matan Torah was the one case where there was, and therefore he says that therefore the relationship still existed. That's a famous maral in the Gur Aryeh in Parshas Vayigash. Now, I just want to point out, though, that what I told you about Avadim is not entirely Muskim. I described the idea of an Eved Kanani as a slave. That means he's acquired against his will. And then you can circumcise him and immerse him against his will. Not all Rishonim understand it that way. Some Rishonim understand that although you can purchase the slave or capture the slave against his will, but the immersion and the circumcision must be voluntary. And if the slave doesn't want to do it, the halacha is you have 1 year to convince him, but after that year you have to sell him. You don't set him free, but you sell him back to the goyim to be a goyisha slave rather than Eved Kanani. So according to the Rambam's view, there would be no such thing as a forced conversion, even of a slave. Other Rishonim do have a different view. Okay, so that would be the idea there. Herod, of all people, Herod, who the Romans eventually installed as king of the Jews in Palestine, in the land of Israel, Herod was in fact the son of a Hasmonean slave. His father was Antipater, who also got himself to be politically well-connected in Roman circles, but he was a slave of the Hashmonai. There were no survivors of the Hasmonean family. The last woman jumped off a roof because Herod was going to forcibly take her as a wife, and as she was falling to her death, she announced, "Anyone that says they are a Hasmonean is really only a slave, is a liar. There are no left. There are none left." So the whole Zera of the Maccabim and the Hashmonaim was indeed wiped out. Yeah.
Well, how come on Purim, we have Megillas Esther, but Hanukkah, there's nothing written that we read or show, and it seems like there's similar holidays in terms of that they're both.
Yes. Okay, so that's a very good question, I have two answers. The first answer is that that Hanukkah occurred after the age of prophecy had lapsed. There were no prophets. And as a result, the idea of books that are written with divine inspiration and holiness no longer existed. And therefore, Hanukkah was not commemorated in that same way, as opposed to Megillas Esther, which was in the biblical period before the building of the Second Temple. It was between the exiles. There still was prophecy and the like. That's answer number one. But answer number two is that although it's not a chiv, there is in fact a document. Maybe you've seen it. It is called Megillas Antiochus. The story, it's like a Megillas Antiochus, which is the story of Hanukkah. Like a Megillah, and there was a custom in many kihilos in the Middle Ages to read the Megillah of Hanukkah on Hanukkah. Now, it was a custom. It didn't become a chiyuv for the first reason that I gave you. But in fact, there is, and I don't know. I don't think the article sitter has it, but in some Siddurim, you can find something called, it's either called Megillas Hanukkah, or it's called Megillat Antiochus. And there is such a thing. There's a machlokus. When was Megillas Antiochus written? Some say it is as old as the Maccabees itself. It is mamish from the time, and others say it was written in the Middle Ages.
What are the reasons why Gemara learning is so emphasized in Sishila?
Well, you say this yeshiva. It's not just this yeshiva. All yeshivas. Yeah. Well, it's a very, very good question, and I don't want to get in trouble by suggesting maybe alternatives might be worthy of consideration. But there is a concept like this. I understand in the question that there is a great difficulty many of us have with Gemara. Number one, language, and that sounds like a big difficulty, but that's really the smallest difficulty. As hard as Aramaic and punctuation is, and that is hard, that is actually the smallest difficulty of learning Gemara. But it's the logic, it's very, very complex, there are so many different ways of looking at things, and you don't get to a bottom line after you finish everything. You still don't know like what the halakha is because you have so many different views, and wouldn't it be easier to learn, the halachos, the final rules, etc.? It is a good question, but the reason why it became so accepted in the yeshiva world and the world of higher learning that Gemara is the big thing that we spend all of our hours on is that the concept is that Gemara teaches you not just information, but it teaches you a thinking process. It teaches you how to analyze. And there is a concept that the Torah is the concretization of God's mind, Kavyocha. And God's mind is equivalent to God's essence. And when you connect to God's mind, you're connected to God in a way that wouldn't be the mere case with mere information. Mere information is much more passive. You hear something, you know, you hear something, you hear it, and that's it. In Gemara, you're forced to make it your own by working, by arguing, by struggling, by trying to figure out. And there is a concept that the more you break yourself, the more you work, the more you strive, the more you think, then the closer it becomes part of your DNA, part of your cells. There's a concept of easy come, easy gone, meaning to say, the Torah that I take in easily, although that's great, it's a good feeling, goes out easily, in one ear, out one ear. The Torah that I struggle to understand, that stays with me. Now, the other problem is this. The other problem, but people say, but yeah, but look at how much you're not doing because we're doing Gemara. What about Chumash? And what about Halacha? I mean, we make time for it, but, you know, it's limited time. And what about Jewish philosophy? And what about history? You know, whatever it is, all of these are addictive. All of these are important things to know. It is a major, major issue. You know, this is what I used to say. You know, in some of the left-wing girls' seminaries, they try to introduce Gemara for girls, although halachically there's some issues about that. So I once said, and I heard another rabbi say the same thing, so Baruch Shekivanti, that, you know, the girls being freed from Gemara, so to speak, have this wonderful curriculum that has a million different types of subjects. So one might argue, instead of the girls' schools trying to be like the boys' schools, maybe the boys' schools ought to be like the girls' schools. But part of the issue of Gemara is that even though it crowds out a lot of things, but the problem basically is that mastery of Gemara is very labor-intensive. By that I mean to say that if you want to reach a level where you will be able to learn Gemara by yourself, you have to put in a lot of hours, a lot of hours. Meaning, if you just did it an hour a day, you would never reach a level where you could learn Gemara by yourself. It's just, I don't want to use irreverent expressions, but it's like the 8,000-pound elephant or whatever it is. In other words, it just crowds out everything because it takes the most time. Most stuff you can get proficiency in much less time, and you can do it later when you're out of yeshiva. Although it's a bit of an excuse. Oh, you'll get to know Chumash when you're out of yeshiva and whatever it is. Now, it's an excuse, but Lamaise, it's a possibility. Gemara just requires that immersion. You know, just otherwise you're not going to get the skill. So, having said all that, it is a difficult question if a Gemara-intensive curriculum is the best derech for every single Ben Torah. It's not so pashut. It's not so pashut. It may very well be that many students would do better with a curriculum that had more inyanim in it. But, you know, it's a hard question because on one hand, those who will become the great Gedolim and the great Talmidei Chachamim need to do it this way. Many people are not going to become the great Gedolim and the like. So the question is, are we creating a curriculum to kind of guarantee the Gedolim at the expense of people who are not going to be Gedolim? It's a very difficult educational challenge. It's not an easy thing. And different people, different Gedolim over the years, and even now, are debating whether there ought to be different types of yeshivos, not just in terms of general hashkafa, like Zionism or something, but in terms of, you know, Gemara versus other things. So, you know, so if I sound like I'm confused, the answer is I am, because it is an issue that we grapple with every day.
What's the issue with women?
The issue with women, okay, that's a separate thing. The Rambam brings lahalacha. The Rambam brings from the Gemara Mishnah in Sota that he who teaches his daughter the oral law is teaching her things which are tasteless and useless and the like. And that's understood by many poskim, that one is not allowed to teach the oral law, Mishnah and Gemara, to women. On the other hand, there is a Prisha, which is a commentary on the Torah, that says that what the Rambam means is you don't make it a mandatory curriculum for girls like you would for boys, but if an adult woman wants on her own to learn Gemara, there's nothing wrong with teaching her. So that is the Prisha, that is a source in Halacha. And the more modern schools, you know, follow that. The more traditional don't follow that. But there is a legitimate makom in halacha for both approaches. Yeah.
Earlier today, you were speaking about the importance of the Ten Commandments, and I thought I heard once before that the Ten Commandments used to be read daily.
Yep.
And so I was going to ask, what was the reason that they were read daily? And the second part of the question is, why do we stop?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. This is the Gemara in Brachos. The Gemara in Brachos says that there was a time in the Beis Hamikdash, where the Aseres Hadibros were read every day, and the reason that was so is because those were the commandments that God gave when He revealed Himself to all of Israel. So, in effect, we were re-experiencing the revelation of Sinai. And therefore, as we commit ourselves to a new day of Avodas Hashem, we experience standing at Har Sinai and hearing the Aseres Hadibros, right? That's why it was read every day. Now, the Gemara then says that the Chachamim decided to discontinue the practice. Why? Because there were people, like there are people today, who say, oh, it's only the Ten Commandments that are important. Now, like Jews always say, I'm not religious, but I keep the Ten Commandments. I told you that joke Rabbi Feldman made about, what about the Fourth Commandment, which is Shabbos, and you know, whatever, okay. The truth is, the people who say they keep the Ten Commandments don't keep all ten. But okay, but be it as it may, it was discontinued because the sages were afraid that people would overemphasize the Ten Commandments over other mitzvahs. Now, based on this, there's a very fascinating tshuva of the Rambam. It's not in the Mishneh Torah, but it's a responsa. You may recall that when we read the Aseres Hadibros in Shul, we stand up. Yeah. The Rambam was critical of that custom, because the Rambam said, if Chazal discontinued the daily reading of the Aseres Hadibros, so you shouldn't think it's more important. Of course, in Yeshiva, many of us stand up anyway, but even if you were sitting, the minhag is to stand up. The Rambam says that's a wrong custom, because when you're standing up, you're giving more importance to the Aseres Hadibros than the rest of the Torah. Rav Moshe Feinstein defends the custom by saying, well, since we also stand up for other parts of the Torah, like Uz Yashir, so you're not just singling out the Ten Commandments, he also suggests that you stand up a few psukim before and remain standing a few psukim afterwards, and the like. Now, one thing, though, that's problematic is, I'm not sure if the Art School Siddur has this, but in some Siddurim, they still have the Ten Commandments recited every day. Does the Art School Siddur have that?
It does have, yeah. That. It says you shouldn't do it.
Oh, well, that's the thing. So the question is, how can the Siddur say, do it every day, if that's the exact thing the Chachamim said not to do? So the answer is that they used to recite it as part of the minyan, and that's what the Chachamim discontinued. But individually, it's still a way of connecting to Matan Torah. So that's why the Art Scroll says, do not recite it publicly, recite it, you can still recite it privately. Yeah?
Would you think that it would be better to, if you're in a minyan that's a Netz minyan, if you have to miss a couple of the verses of Pesukah Zimra, would you recommend that you would skip those to make a Netz minyan, or to just wait and in all of
Pesukah Zimra? Wow, that's a very, very good question. I don't have a very clear answer, because both of them are extremely important. Netz is extremely great mitzvah, but Pesukah Zimra is also. I would say, though, that I think Pesukah Zimra would have precedence, because that is a takana of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, and therefore even Vasikin. See, it's interesting. Vasikin, davening kevasikin, is more important than minyan. That's interesting. If you're in a place that doesn't have a minyan for vasikin, and it's still better to daven vasikin than to go to a minyan. Vasikin is to daven with the nates. So vasikin overrides minyan, and I just read from Rav Chaim Kanevsky, vasikin, which is very surprising to me, even overrides tefillin. In other words, he had a shita that, let's say for some reason you didn't have your tefillin with you, and you're not going to have your tefillin till a later minyan? He says, still, daven sunrise without tefillin, and then put on your tefillin later and say the Shema. So Vasikin does override some very important stuff, but I think it would not override the actual Seder of the tefillah itself.
I was wondering how before the Mishnah was written down, how the oral law was transmitted, because now we learn the discussions from the Tanaim. So how was that taught?
So the problem basically was there was no single way it was taught, meaning to say Klal Yisrael had many, many teachers who had received the oral law, and each one communicated the information according to their style, meaning the oral law by definition did not have an exact way to say it. In other words, it had a content that was transmitted, but how a teacher would communicate that content was a function of the individual teaching method of that teacher. So we don't have the transcript. That's why the Gemara says, for example, when Rav Yehuda HaNasi wrote the Mishnah, there were 400 versions of Mishnah already in existence. Now, what that basically means is everybody organized the material in a different way, and he was choosing what is the best way to organize the material. So because it was oral, though, we don't have the written scripts that they used. There weren't any written scripts. But we would just have to say that part of the idea of the oral law, and let me explain why this is so. Part of why it was kept oral is that each student needs a different way of being taught, and therefore Hashem made the Torah to be such that each teacher would be able to formulate it in the way that was best for their particular Talmud. Okay, that's how it works. Okay, it was not an exact script. Again, as I said a few days ago, the idea that the Mishnah is part of the oral law does not mean that the Mishnah word for word was transmitted from Moshe B'Sinai. We're talking about the content, the concepts, but the particular nusach of the Mishnah was a product of Rav Yehuda HaNasi, and these were his words, or these were not the words that were handed down from Moshe B'Sinai. Yeah.
Well, in regards to Psukei Zimra, sometimes minyanim go quickly, and you're not able to finish. But I think Mishra says like you can go back if you have kavana later on after you finish davening. How do you rate your kavana if you're going to do it well back? And is that what we should do, or should we just leave it be?
First of all, it is a big machlokish. Now the Haterim that in order to make tefillah b'tzibor, you're allowed to shorten, to skip certain portions of Pesukei Dezimra. You cannot skip anything from Yishtabach onwards, but in the Pesukim, but the Evid, for example, if you're really pressed for time, just saying Ashrei, Baruch Shamar, Ashrei, Yishtabach would be sufficient, and skipping the rest. But there's a big, big machlokas. If I skipped, do I have to make up what I skipped after davening? So the Mishnah Berurah says it's better to. The Aruch HaShulchan says no reason whatsoever, because the Aruch HaShulchan says Pesukei Dezimra was enacted as a preliminary to Kriya Shema and Shmoneh Esrei. Once it's not preliminary to Kriya Shema and Shmoneh Esrei, you don't have to say it. Now, you're allowed to say it because it's mainly Tehillim. I mean, I can say the Tehillim. So the Aruch HaShulchan said there is no chiyuv to say it. Different people have different customs. Many people do follow the Aruch HaShulchan on this, and particularly if they're pressed for time and it would cause Bittul Torah to be late to Seder. So I don't think you have to be overly machmir on it. But still, if you do have the time, it would be a good thing to do. And how do you measure kavana? Well, what can I say? Most of the time our kavana is lacking, and that might be a reason to follow the Aruch HaShulchan as well. Yeah.
So Hashem took us out of Egypt to give us the Torah, so these chosen people, so on and so forth. Yet he was talking to the patriarchs, the Hebrew people, before we were even returned to Egypt. So my question is, did all nations receive this treatment, or were we handheld to be taken to Matan Torah, Mount Sinai?
And if so, why were we not given it earlier, say, to Jacob and Yaakov and his sons?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a very excellent question, and in a way, it's reminiscent of these fiction books that write alternative histories, like what would have happened if Hitler would have won the war. You know, in effect, here's the problem, right? We have a whole pre-Matan Torah history of God's involvement with the Jewish people. Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov. Now, if you're telling me God then offers the Torah to all the nations of the world, well, what if the Chinese would have taken it? Let's say they would have said yes. Well, what would happen to that prehistory, so to speak, of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? Like, just one, never mind, you know, skip it. And would the Chinese have had some prehistory of Avos and Imos? Probably not, as far as I know. You know, we don't have anything there. So it is a very, very difficult question. The truth of the matter is, some commentaries suggest that God was always going to give the Torah to the Jewish people. That's not the question. He also would have admitted the non-Jews in it as well, similar to a conversion process. But it's very, very clear that the Jewish people were the ones that were intended to get it all along. Now, why didn't God give it earlier? I mean, the short answer is, although we don't fully have, can pinpoint this, is that Klal Yisrael needed to go through a developmental process. In many, many ways, the Torah compares the Egyptian exile to the smelting of metal, in which it must go through a hard, hot furnace in order to burn out impurities. There were certain impurities of character. We needed to go through this from a sociological standpoint, which is religiously very important. The Egyptian experience gave us empathy and compassion for the downtrodden, which is a fundamental aspect of the Jewish soul. It gave us a sense of community and achdus, common suffering. So this was a process that was needed to take place. Just as Avraham had a Yishmael that was represented a certain separation of the bad, and Yitzchak had an Esav, so too, even within Am Yisrael, there was residual impurities that needed to come out. In fact, the Chiddushei Harim says a very startling insight. It's a little bit sad. You know, we were supposed to be in Mitzrayim 400 years. And had we been in Mitzrayim 400 years, we would have been perfected, and the Mashiach would have come, and that would have been it. But Hashem had to take us out 190 years early because we were assimilating. So it's like the chemotherapy had to be stopped because the patient was dying. It would kill the patient. But unfortunately, when you stop the chemotherapy early, there's still some cancer that can grow. So the Chiddushei Harim says, the reason we need thousands of years of galus is because we never completed the 400 years in Mitzrayim. Had we completed the 400 years in Mitzrayim, we wouldn't have needed a galus. So, it's compound interest on galus. Had we been able to last 190 more years, we wouldn't have needed the 2,000 years that we go through now. So, as I say, I can't pinpoint exactly what we needed. HaKadosh Baruch Hu knew that, but that was built into the process. And remember, let me remind you too, that Hashem told Abraham that as well. Right? Hashem told Abraham that your children are going to be enslaved in the land that is not theirs, and they will leave Egypt to get great wealth. And Chazal say the great wealth is Matan Torah. So God is specifically saying Matan Torah comes after the exodus of Egypt.
Well, I forget the particular man's name, but it's the story of, you know, he's riding on his prophet, he was riding on his donkey, angel came down, killed the donkey in Right. Do you know what I'm talking about, or are we?
Why don't you finish the story? I'm not sure.
That's pretty much it. Like, Bilam?
Yes.
Oh, Bilam. Oh, okay. In the Chumash, yeah. Okay.
Yes. So, he was meant to be a prophet to
the nations of the world. Yes, correct.
Yes, to the non-Jewish nations.
Yep.
So, and it explains that. And the other nations of the world, they all got a prophet so that they could have a connection to God. So the question is, since God already had his chosen people, why? And moreover, if they were non-Jewish nations, why would they need a prophet to one small people?
Well, once again, I think there's still an issue of fairness, meaning to say that even if God has a chosen nation, But God has to give opportunity. Now, Lemaisa, there is opportunity. There's something called conversion, where every person in the world can become a Jew, a member of the Jewish nation. But on the other hand, when you have these nations that are so far from Jews, they have to have some avenue that God gives them that they could see the light. Now, today, we have email and internet. We have, in other words, there are so many ways the Jewish message gets out. But in the time when you didn't have those things, God had to give them spiritual figures who conceivably could bring them to enlightenment. Now, because there's free will, what happened was these so-called spiritual leaders themselves became corrupted and degenerate. Right? Bilam was hardly a spiritual light, as it were, but potentially he was. God gave him the ability, God gave him the talents, God gave him the insight. Bilam decided to use them for his own self-aggrandizement. That's not God's fault. He says, I gave you the gifts. You misuse them. Yeah.
What's the Makor to Shever Brachos? And is it a complete
chiyuv? Okay. Well, the Makor of Shever Brachos, this is a... are you a chassan, by the way? Did
no.
I? No, okay. Second. Okay. I don't want to miss a mazel tov, but okay. yeah. No, the thing is that the Makor of Shever Brachos is a Gemara in Ksuvas. It is a Gemara. And here is the idea. Reciting Sheva Brachos at the Chasna itself is an absolute chiyuv. You are mechuyuv to recite Sheva Brachos at a Chasna. Now, to recite the Sheva Brachos for the entire week, every single day, it is only a chiyuv if there is a minyan that is gathered in honor of the Chasna and the Kala. Meaning, if there are 10 people, including the Chasna, 9 people plus the chassan, who are there to honor and rejoice with the chassan, there is a chiyuv to recite Sheva Brachos. But contrary to popular opinion, there is no chiyuv to create such a gathering. Now, it's become almost commonplace, universal, 99.9%, that we make special parties every single day and have Sheva Brachos. But there absolutely is no chiyuv to do so. And in fact, the old minhag of Yerushalmis, primarily because of poverty, is they didn't make any Sheva Brachos at all. Meaning they made the wedding Sheva Brachos, and Shabbos they did something, but they didn't have Sheva Brachos during the week. What I mean is, in other words, they didn't assemble a minyan to recite Sheva Brachos. Now again, probably... it's not so much that they didn't want to do it for Davka, but probably, they were poor, or they couldn't afford these parties every night. So there absolutely is no chiyuv to make Sheva Brachos every day.
Yeah. This is interesting because my brother got married recently, and it was during the Sheva Brachos, it was snowing, and it was like really bad out, and like there's some rebbeim, like told him that like you don't necessarily have to, but you should really try to get 10 people, and you should try to make a Sheva Brachos. But it was like really hard for people to get together. So would you say in that scenario that...
Well, all I can tell you is that Shlomo Zalman did not have Sheva Brachos every day, so I don't think you have to try that hard.
It would be like a tircha for people to get together.
Well, let me put it this way, though. One way to look at it is, if they do get together and recite, they're doing a mitzvah. Mm-hmm. So it's not something, it's not a mitzvah they have to do, but if they're doing it, they are doing a mitzvah. So I think generally you could say that since doing mitzvos give a person spiritual reward, so maybe for that reason alone it's a good thing to do. But whether or not you should really do it in the snow, that would depend. What can I tell you? That would depend on how much snow or whatever it would be.
We know that Hashem doesn't meddle with a man's free will. Is it safe to say that Paro was an exception?
Well, Paro is one of the exceptions. Again, the famous question of Hashem hardening Paro's heart is the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva asks the question, Hashem hardens Paro's heart. And the Rambam actually says, he doesn't say Paro was an exception. He actually says Paro exemplifies an exception generally. Mm-hmm. And that is, if a person sins against Hashem over and over and over again, part of the punishment that Hashem gives, Hashem takes away his free will, so we cannot do tshuva. And the Rambam points out that Paro was not punished because he hardened his heart. Paro was punished for all of the sins he did before Hashem hardens his heart. But Paro would have done tshuva, then Hashem couldn't punish him. So since Hashem wanted to punish him because of his evil, he took away his ability to do tshuva by hardening his heart. And the Rambam says, the same way, God forbid, a punishment for sin could be all sorts of disabilities. A person might lose a leg, lose an arm. We're not saying that's the only reason it happens, but it might happen. So too, you could lose free will. That's part of the onesh Hashem gives you. And that's why it says Hashem hardened Pyro's heart only for the second five makos. The first five makos says Pyro hardened his own heart. So makos 1-5 were Pyro's own sin. He would have done tshuva. Hashem took away his free will, so he wouldn't do tshuva. So all the punishments are for the first sins, not the second sins. Yeah.
Just to clarify, if we're saying that saying all of Pasuka de Zimra is more important than davening the Sikin,
yeah,
and that the Sikin is more important than davening with a minion, then why do we skip some of Pasuka de Zimra to
daven with the minion? That is a great brain teaser kasha. Let me think about that. That's really that's quite excellent kasha. According to that logic, if a vasikin is more important than minion, then a vasikin must be more important than psukha de zimra, because minion is more important than psukha de zimra. Let me think about it.
Vasikin overrides minion only when the person is accustomed to.
That's true also. In other words, that's a necessary qualifier. That when we say vasikin overrides minion, that's only if that is your minna kavu. Yeah. But that's still, that doesn't answer. His question is still a good question. Let me think about it. It's a good question. Yeshkoach, yeah.
Is mental illnesses considered for taking free will? That person loses free will?
Well, excellent question. Of course, mental illness is not a single category. You know, mental illness can be a whole range of things. Now, at some point...
Schizophrenia.
Yeah. It may under certain circumstances. There is a category in halacha called shota, and a shota is exempt from commandments because he doesn't have the capacity to control himself. But here, let me just point out, there's a very helpful concept that Rav Dessler in Michta Me'elio talks about, and he says free will does not exist in the same way for everybody. But everybody has something in which Hashem expects them to exercise free will. So, for example, if I'm a drug addict in the throes of a cocaine addiction, I don't have free will to say I'm going to go to kollel now, you know. Or I don't have free will to say I'm going to say no to drugs totally. But I do have free will to go to a detox center. In other words, I don't have the free will of totally getting rid of something at this point. But I have there's a certain fork in the road I could take. I could do something. And that is what Hashem holds me accountable for. This is called, in Rav Dessler's language, Nekudas HaBechira. Nekudas HaBechira means there's a point, there's a fulcrum. And as you grow spiritually, your Nekuda moves. For example, there are certain areas of life which are so beyond the pale of where I am that I don't exercise Bechira. For example, if you've been a religious Jew, if you don't turn on a light on Shabbos, are you exercising free will? No, because it's not a struggle. Free will is what you're struggling with. Now, certain things are so part of my life that they're no longer a struggle. Not to kill. I didn't murder anybody today. Am I going to get reward because I exercised free will not to murder? No, because you don't have a Yetzirah for that. So certain areas you've already taken care of, and certain areas are so beyond me that I'm not yet ready to even struggle with them. Bechira is the relatively narrow range in which you're living the life of active struggle. You might succeed, you might fail, you struggle. Sometimes you get it right, sometimes you get it wrong. So the drug addict is struggling, should I go to a treatment center? At some point, the person who's not yet keeping Shabbos may struggle, I'm not going to smoke on Shabbos. But at some point, the level becomes higher and higher and higher and higher. So when you've already been a Shomer Shabbos for many, many years, your struggle is not, am I going to smoke? But your struggle is, am I going to learn on Shabbos or sleep too much? That's called the Nekuda of Bechira. So I would say, based on that idea, that even a schizophrenic does have Bechira, but it may not be in the same realm as all of us. In other words, what could he have done given his condition? Now, not that you should see this movie. In fact, I did not see this movie either. I didn't see movies, but I'm aware of it. The movie, it's A Wonderful Mind, is it?
Beautiful
Mind, yeah. So you see over there, it's quite an amazing story, at least the way I read the story, that a person in the throes of very severe mental illness was somehow able to make a certain choice to be a certain way. You're hearing voices in your mind, and you say, okay, these are voices. Now, that takes a tremendous amount of strength, but that is something that is within the realm of possibility. So there is a free will component, even in those situations. Yeah?
How authorized are we to give tokocha nowadays?
Okay, general rule is don't do it. Then we talk about exceptions when you do it. There is a mitzvah, I have to explain what I'm saying. There is a mitzvah in the Torah. A mitzvah. When I see somebody doing a sin, I am supposed to correct them. I'm supposed to chastise them. I'm supposed to tell them, this is wrong. Right? So I read the Chumash. The Chumash says I'm supposed to be interventionist and be concerned. All of that is 100% true. Giving tokacha is a mitzvah in the Torah. Despite that fact, in the overwhelming majority of situations, don't do it. Because the purpose of tokacha is to bring a Jew back to God by giving him the encouragement to do a mitzvah. Now, most of the time, when we give tokacha and we don't act out of love and real concern, the person resents us more, resents the Torah more, will become defensive, will become hostile. And what you've done by your tokacha is you have driven him further away from Hashem than closer to Hashem. And under those circumstances, Chazal say, better to be quiet, better not to say things that are going to be ignored, because it is likely that there will be hostility and defensiveness and resentment, and then you have destroyed the whole purpose of tokacha. You have made it counterproductive. Now, if the only problem would be ineffective, I would still tell you to do it, because, all right, it'll either work or not work, but that's not the problem. If the problem would only be it'll either work or not work, so go ahead and do it. The problem is, there's a third possibility, you will make it worse. And if you will make it worse, then it's certainly better not to say it at all. Yeah. Now, having said that, is there any case of tokacha? Yeah. If you have a close friend, and the close friend knows that you care about them, and you can talk to him in a gentle, non-condemning way, then yes, that's what good friends do. Good friends, really good friends. Now, you have to be a real good friend. If it's just a social relationship, it doesn't work. But someone that you really care about, yeah, you say, you know, I love you, I care about you, and it hurts me a lot that, you know, you're wandering away from Torah and Yiddishkeit. How can I help you? Or what can we do to strengthen? That's good tokacha, and that's a mitzvah. You're doing a mitzvah when you do it.
So how does one go about, I guess, you know, bettering themselves if, you know, sometimes people don't see in themselves, like, what they can make better? Usually it's when other people tell them.
Okay, so you can ask. Yes. You can ask. That's exactly right. In fact, that used to be done in the Musar yeshivas,
yeah,
in which you would ask, how can I be a better person? Or you can tell the person ahead of time, if you're strong enough. Now, you have to be willing to live with the answer.
Yeah.
You know, like these bosses at these meetings always say, tell me what I'm doing wrong. You know, and as soon as you say any criticism, you're out of the door, you know. You know, that's what happens in the business world all the time. So you can tell your friend, if you see me doing anything wrong, please tell me. But you have to be strong enough to be willing to hear the answer. You can't do it as a fake thing.
We have a commandment to write to Sefer Torah, but I've heard that writing a letter doesn't count, and anything paying less than half doesn't count. Is there any way you can actually fulfill this mitzvah?
Well, it's a good question. You know, the 613th commandment, the last commandment of the Torah, is that every Jew should write their own Sefer Torah. And many people try to fulfill this by buying a letter, and etc. But as you pointed out, some opinions say a letter is not a Sefer Torah. Lamaisa, some opinions do say you do fulfill it with a letter. You know, that's one answer. I mean, some say you do fulfill it. But the other answer is the Rush. Rabbeinu Usher writes that the purpose of writing a Sefer Torah was, in the time of the Chazal even, people would learn from the Torah scrolls. And therefore, you're writing something that you're going to use to learn. Since Bisman Hazeh, we learn from Svarim. We don't learn from a Sefer Torah. So the Rush says, if you buy Svarim, you buy Jewish Svarim to learn, you fulfill the mitzvah of writing a Sefer Torah. Mm-hmm. So based on that, most people, in yeshiva certainly, have fulfilled the mitzvah many times over. When you buy a Gemara, according to the Rush, you have fulfilled the mitzvah. Now, because that's a machlokas in and of itself, so we try to cover our bases partially, meaning we both contribute to a letter to fulfill at least that view, and we buy Svarim. So together you have two different authorities that you can rely upon.
Do the big person of today hold by those opinions? They can do those.
But basically that's how it is. That's how most people do it. Now, if you really want to do the mitzvah properly, so for $25,000, you can commission a Sefer Torah. That's good. That is the best way of doing it, indeed. Or if you really want to do it super duper, you train yourself to be a sofer, and then you yourself write the Sefer Torah itself.
How long does that take?
Well, it depends how naturally skilled. I mean, there are many people who know the halachas of writing, but they're not necessarily artistic enough. But it's under a year. It's under a year. In fact, some yeshivas have a nice program. Some yeshivas actually offer safras courses that train guys in under a year to be qualified sofers. Yeah.
About Jewish history, up until, I guess, the museum, the concept of it, the Jewish people have had leadership to tell them what, in terms of the Klal perspectives, they need to work on. So after, you know, different tragedies happened, or if there was the warnings, we always knew something to aim towards. Today, can we say the same thing of being that we don't have, like, Nevi'im, I guess, so do we look for to Torah leadership to say what's the Klal perspectives that we're supposed to work on, and or is that just not, we don't have that anymore, and as a Klal we don't really know as what we're supposed to be doing, and we should just work on, I mean, obviously you should work on personal things as well, but
By definition, Hashem will never leave the Jewish people bereft of spiritual guidance and leadership. So when we lost Nevuah, which was the direct connection to Hashem, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu inspires the Chachamim to teach us, not just... See, people make a big mistake. This is kind of one of the differences between, let's say, modern Orthodoxy, and certainly open Orthodoxy, and let's say the more Haredi world, is that sometimes in the modern segments, they look at Gedolim as technicians, plumbers, meaning to say the following. They'll say, oh, Gedolim know Talmud and Shulchan Aruch, so they will tell me what to do if my dishwasher got treif. But when it comes to, you know, what type of life I should live, or who I should marry, or what type of job I should have, those are not halachic questions, because they're not in the Shulchan Aruch. So this Rav Chaim Kineski's opinion is no better than my opinion. That's kind of the idea. Now, in the, I don't want to say the more Torah world, because, you know, every world is a Torah world. I don't want to put that to say. But in the more traditional world, we recognize that those who are connected to Torah learning are not just technicians who give you answers about Shabbos clocks and dishwashers, but people that have a perspective and a philosophy of life. We very much believe that our Gedolim guide us and give us priorities and give us parameters and give us hashkafos. They are the prophetic voices, so to speak, even though we don't have Nevi'im. Now, having said that, though, I do want to put one cautionary note, and that is the Gedolim set the general philosophies, the general hashkafos of life. But in order to know how to apply that to you, you cannot just take a general pronouncement and apply it to you. You have to have a Rebbe, number one, who knows you individually. And number two, you have to have your own common sense as well. You know, you don't surrender your brain and your mind because you believe in Gedolim that give you guidance. You have to use, you know, Hashem did not take away the responsibility for your life from you. So there still is going to be that need for tailor-making. In fact, one of the problems we have in Eretz Yisrael is that people often take the statements of Gedolim as categorical commandments to them as individuals. It isn't always the case. The Gedolim are setting general guidelines. And for example, the army, right? The Gedolim kind of said, you know, no army, no army, no army, no army. But that doesn't mean you as an individual can't go to the army. That just means, you know, we're against compulsory draft, we're against the government deciding who stays in yeshiva. On a one-to-one basis, again, don't get me in trouble there, on a one-to-one basis, there may be individual people who the army could be a very positive experience. You know, there are people sometimes who hang around yeshiva, they're not really learning that well, and the army could give them discipline and structure. Maybe. And the Gedolim are not saying no to that. You see, they're talking about a general policy. But what's best for you has to be based on a unique relationship. And that is why sometimes it's not always the wisest thing to go to the Gadol Hador for an answer to you. Because the Gadol Hador doesn't know you. Rav Chaim Kineski will see you for 35 seconds, if you're lucky. But you need somebody, you know, who could sit down with you for an hour or 2 hours, if necessary. You see what I'm saying? So, but I do believe Hashem has given us at least a substitute for Nevuah in the Gedolim that we have. Yeah.
Why, as a collective people and faith, have we given up on the Ark?
On the what?
On the Ark of the Covenant.
Oh, okay. The Ark of the Covenant. Well, you know, first of all, remember that we have not had the Ark of the Covenant since the destruction of the first temple. Remember, we did not have the ark in the entire second temple. I think the short answer is that the ark is symbolic of the revelation of God's presence in this world, the Shekhinah. And until Hashem rebuilds the Beis HaMikdash, we are not worthy of that Gilui HaShekhinah. Meaning we're not supposed to get it until Hashem shows that we're worthy. There has to be a sign from heaven. That's why we don't build the temple. You could ask the same question. The Rambam writes, only the coming of Mashiach will allow the building of the temple. Now, having said that, there are stories, I don't know if they're true, that in the time of the Chafetz Chaim, there was a man who actually discovered the Ark of the Covenant, and he went to the Chafetz Chaim, and he showed the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim ordered the paper and the instructions to be burnt and kept secret, and the man died shortly thereafter. So there is a concept that it's not yet for us. And of course, the idea, the Gemara itself says that if you encounter the Ark when you're not yet worthy of it, you get burnt, right? You get burnt with the heavenly fire. It was considered to be a dangerous thing. It's like super nuclear energy, you know, that you're not ready to get, right? So one has to be very, very careful. Okay, have a good evening.